Hello and welcome to episode 27 of Across the Bifrost, where Pat and I dive into Ebony Maw and Black Dwarf. Before we go into that episode, though, I do want to take a moment and shout out a few different people and groups. The first being all the patrons. Thank you so much for supporting the pod, for keeping the lights on, for helping us pay for the hosting fees and microphones. You can check that out at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. You can get access to our Discords and episodes a week early. I also want to shout out Discount Games Incorporated, selling products at the maximum allowed discount price. You can find them at discountgamesinc.com. And here in America, at least in the States, all these items are releasing in June now. So, hey, there's a lot of stuff to catch up on. If your local game store doesn't support MCP, be sure to check out Discount Games Inc. Last and certainly not least is Muse on Minis. I love Muse, made by gamers, for gamers, a whole bunch of great products, terrain. Check out Muse on Minis and museonstore.com. For your future gaming needs. All right, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Pat Dunford about Ebony Maw and Black Dwarf.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up high,
on the line now, across the pond, and still safe, considering the world might be ending, is my dear co-host, Pat Dunford. Pat, how are you holding up?
I'm holding up really well, thank you, TT. I'm kept afloat by the phenomenal wave of spoilers that we've been receiving from AMG. Thank you so much, Atomic Mass Games. Everything you're sharing is awesome. I can't wait to talk about it.
Yeah, and we have a great episode coming up today. We are talking about some new characters for the Black Order. We're going to be talking about Black Dwarf and Ebony Maw. And if you're a member of the Patreons, you can hear this episode a week early. So if you haven't checked it out or are interested in supporting the pod, please check us out at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. You get episodes early. You get access to our bonus episodes. We call them after the credit scenes. You get access to the Discord and a few other things, some giveaways and other things that happen randomly. So if you want to support the pod, check us out at patreon.com/acrossthebifrost. So, Pat, today we have Black Dwarf and Ebony Maw. We still haven't seen Thanos yet, but the Black Order is shaping up to be pretty impressive.
They're amazing. Oh, my gosh. And this box is phenomenal. I think this is probably the most excited I've been for a box because both the characters are great. We get four cards. They're all great. Everything is looking superb. Chatting on Discord, and we're already seeing people considering playing Black Order without Thanos just because the tactics cards are so good. They seem to be phenomenal.
Yeah, a whole lot of power coming out of them. And Will Pagani actually mentioned that he likes a dual affiliation roster that doesn't run Thanos. When he ends up with Ebony Maw kind of quote-unquote leading the Black Order affiliation, right? And some interesting tech there. So let's go ahead and let's get into it. Do we want to start off with the big boy or do we want to start off with the mentalist?
Let's do alphabetical order, so that's Black Dwarf first.
All right, so Black Dwarf is a 4 threat character, size 4, 6 stamina on the healthy side, 8 on the backside with 4-3-3 defenses. So he is a tanky boy. He's a beefcake. I don't mean to assume gender. I assume Black Dwarf is a male, but that's probably inappropriate considering it's 2020. He has 2 attacks, both physical. Axe Strike is his first one. Range 2, 6 dice, and then pretty basic strike. He gains damage equal to damage dealt. And then his spender is Brutal End. It has a wild stagger, and it's range 3, 8 attack dice, and it does cost 4. So if we were to just look at his stats and attacks, he's really fat, right? Like 14 stamina is not nothing.
Yeah, I would describe him as being simple but effective, right? He's literally speed S, but he's really tough, and his attacks hit really hard.
Right, and a lot of times, like, I appreciate the simplicity. I don't need a bunch of other stuff tossed in I have to pay points for. I just want someone to walk forward, not die, and smash someone with an axe. I think Black Dwarf kind of fills that role marvelously.
Mm-hmm. Then his powers are pretty good, too. He's got Black Fury, which is his throw. It costs him 3. He can throw size 4 or less terrain or characters within range 2 and throw at medium. So this is a pretty powerful throw, much better than average. Of course, you'd expect it to throw size 4 because he himself is also size 4. Then you've got Enforced Oblivion. This is a weird power. It costs 2. It's an action This character makes a move action. The next attack it makes this activation, add two dice to its attack roll. So you're basically spending two power only to move. And then if you make another attack, you will get two more dice on it. So if your plan for the turn is to move an attack, you're spending two power to get two more damage dice. I just wanted to explain that because already I've seen a lot of people confusing this with charge. It is not charge. It is not nearly as good as charge. You do not get two actions for the price of one, but you are doing even more damage when you have the power to spend.
Yeah, and we'll cover this in an upcoming episode. We've covered it before. There are a lot of tactics cards that basically trade two power for two attack dice, right? I don't want to name them. I think there's three in particular. So I like it, but it is... I think it's great that you pointed that out. A lot of people think it's a much better charge. It's not. It's a worse charge. But he does have a way to move up the board. So it's a fine ability.
Yeah. And then his last active superpower, Intimidating Presence. This is reactive. When an enemy character within range 2 of this character targets another allied character with an attack, this character may use the superpower. This character becomes the target of the attack, regardless of range and line of sight. So this is also confusing because people think it's Bodyguard and it's not Bodyguard. Bodyguard is, if you attack my character and my bodyguard's in range 2, my bodyguard is attacked instead. This is, if you're attacking any of my characters and Black Dwarf is in range of 2 of you, then I can make you attack Black Dwarf instead. So it's kind of like an aggressive bodyguard. It doesn't matter if Black Dwarf is near his friends, but if Black Dwarf is near the enemy, then they're forced to attack him.
Yeah, so right off the bat, I like Black Dwarf. Let me say that. But he's a complicated character who has more depth to him than I think immediately meets the eye, right? People look at him and they think he's just going to walk forward and smash things. And, okay, well, that is what he does. But his positioning for Intimidating Presence is really relevant. He's only small. He's on a large base. So where he's going to kind of end up is something you really need to plan out, right?
Yes, for sure. His last power is his invulnerable skin. When this character would suffer damage from any effect, reduce the amount suffered by one to a minimum of one. So we've seen this before. This is the third Black Order character with this ability, right? Corvus Glaive, Approxima Midnight have Glaive of Immortality and Invulnerability, and Invulnerable Skin is the same deal. So Invulnerable Skin is great, but this is on a character with 4-3-3 defenses and 14 total stamina for 4 threat. What the heck?
He's very hard to displace. He is he's an angry Black Dwarf. I mean, he's a supernova star, right?
I think it's fair to say that he is the toughest character in the game. Now, you could argue that Hulk is tougher, but please. Like, this guy is tougher than Thor and MODOK, and they were the other characters that are in contention.
I mean, I think he's actually tougher than Hulk, right? We can make a straightaway comparison. He is 6 and 8. So at the bare minimum, you have to hit him for 7 damage and 9 damage to take him out, right? At the minimum to take Black Dwarf out is you have to hit him for 7 and 9, right? We agree? So already we're up to 16. Like, so Hulk has 4 more, but Hulk has way worse defenses compared to this.
Yeah, to be pedantic, you could line up a dozen Shuris and hit him for 6 and 8 with single dice attack, single damage attacks. But yeah, you're right that realistically speaking, the extra health that he's going to get from Invulnerable Skin is going to be much more than the difference between him and Hulk, plus the fact that being dazed saves you damage as well.
Right, and that's what I was trying to point out. I agree that I think he is the... I guess Ultron, because of Age of Ultron, might come into this conversation, but in just on the Team Tactics card, or just on the Hero card, Black Dwarf is incredibly resilient.
Yeah, so if you consider that we're rating him above 5 threat characters and probably above Hulk, who's 6 threat, but he's only 4. He's just so tough.
Yeah, and then honestly, anything else he does is just gravy to me. Just the fact that I can stick him somewhere, I'm like, he's going to be fine. Like, he's not going anywhere. He's going to be real angry, and he's going to be A-okay. And if we factor that up with any number of the healing effects we had, we went over those in one of the after credit scenes, he just becomes ridiculous.
Yes. Like, you're never really planning to take him down, right? You just can't realistically create situations where you want to take him down. It's just not worth it for his threat value. He's just so tough. Why bother? And then, obviously, one of the things that's great about him is the fact that his attacks hit so hard that if you ignore him, he's going to punish you quite severely.
Yeah, and then you might just not be able to ignore him, right? If he's able to get close enough to you, intimidating presence is monstrous. Just like shaping and changing where the attacks go is huge. And if you happen to be playing Black Dwarf and you have Field Dress in your hand, it can be a really kind of demoralizing hurdle for your opponent to try to jump over.
Yes. Intimidating presence is really cool. It's really interesting because the play and counterplay to it are so different to Bodyguard, even though the powers on the surface look so similar. Obviously, whenever Black Dwarf is threatening intimidating presence, you could just walk away, right? If you're really worried about it, just go away, and then he can't intimidate you anymore. But that's such a high price to pay for a character with good attacks that wants to be using them, that you could often find yourself in a catch-22 situation where if Black Dwarf is in your face, then you're never really going to get a good attack activation out of that character.
Yeah, especially if he's somewhere where you need to be contesting an objective as well, right? You might not be able to walk away from it, right? Where you'll cede that point to the person. I do think one important counterplay to Black Dwarf is to remember charge. So many people forget charge kind of when the lines have already clashed, but charge giving you that ability to take a move action with an attack onto it might be more relevant when you're trying to escape intimidating presence.
Yes. On the subject of counterplay, another important thing to mention, he's speed short, and he has intimidating presence. He's a really good target to be pushed. He's a really good target to be thrown, although his size 4 makes that difficult. If you can push him away with his large base, he's going a long, long way. Even a short push will probably take him out of range to intimidate anyone. So he is definitely a character who you would rather be controlling with movement effects rather than trying to beat down with damage.
Yeah, and I think he's a fantastic candidate to throw, too. I know a lot of people can't throw size 4 things, but if you can throw him, A, just being size 4, he does a lot of damage, like Pat said, and he's going to move real far. So there's definitely control effects, hit him hard. And then anything we've kind of talked about before, like, you know, stun, stagger, those kind of effects, they really impact him, right? They're things he doesn't want to deal with.
Yes, for sure. One thing you just made me think about, like, throwing size 4 characters into their teammates is really strong. It's a huge problem for MODOK, who often wants to be next to Red Skull, and then poor Red Skull will get splatted by MODOK if he runs into Thor. But Black Dwarf, at least, has a strong game plan where he wants to be away from his friends, right? Because he's so tough, he can survive on his own basically forever. And intimidating presence doesn't require any of his friends to be near him for him to protect them. So I like that he might be a little bit less vulnerable to those big throws than someone like MODOK is.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I just love how he has abilities in intimidating presence and just honestly smashing people in the face where you can't ignore him. But he's able to support himself in a vacuum, right? So many of the times, because I play so much Avengers, I'm looking at, okay, Cap needs to support this character, and this character is able to do these things. MODOK's a great example, right? Cap keeps MODOK alive. MODOK does other things. And I can't tell you the number of times Cap has had MODOK thrown into him, right? Now, since Cap is better than Red Skull, he doesn't die, but it's still an annoying thing. I don't like dealing with it. But I love the Black Dwarf in a vacuum can be a very functional and efficient character, and he forces your opponent to deal with him, right? Between intimidating presence and just hitting people with an axe.
Yes, I think a common play pattern for him will be he double moves on turn one, and then he faces off against whoever he faces off against. He doesn't really care who's facing him down because his defenses are so good. And at some point, he gets thrown away or pushed, and then his game plan just becomes enforced oblivion forward, make a massive axe strike, get power, Black Fury, throw them away. And you can just do that turn on turn for a long time. You probably won't enforce oblivion every time, but your game plan can just be walk up, hit you, throw you. Do you want to do the same to me? Okay, let's do this. Let's see which of our characters last longer. It's probably going to be Black Dwarf.
So I have gotten a proxy game in with Black Dwarf online, Pat. And you know what my favorite thing to do with Black Dwarf is on turn one?
Tell me.
Throw him with Hulk. So you gamma launch him into the middle of the table. Intimidating presence only costs one, and you're like, I don't know, you just got to deal with this guy. You'll figure it out. And in the meantime, Hulk is coming up behind him. So I like that. It was cute. Any kind of movement effect for Black Dwarf is really big, right? Even Red Skull, right? Placing him forward, that could be huge for Black Dwarf.
Yes, especially because of he's got that huge base. So place effects make him go even further, relatively speaking. I think you're right. He seems like a great Avenger between intimidating presence, Enforced Oblivion, and Black Fury, and playing into their game plan of being tough and outlasting. I like the idea of having bodyguards and intimidating presence and making it so difficult for your opponent to target what they want.
Yeah, so I really like Black Dwarf. Is there anything else we want to talk about about Black Dwarf, or should we move on to Mr. Ebony Maw?
Yeah, let's move on to Ebony Maw, who is the polar opposite of Black Dwarf. Completely different character. Oh my gosh. He's a weird one. He's not nearly as tough. He's got 7 stamina on his front, which is great, but only 4 on his injured side, so 11 total. And he's clocking in at 5 threat. So he's very expensive, and 11 stamina for 5 threat is garbage, right? It's awful. Then his defenses are 2 physical, 2 energy, and 6 mystic, which is super weird, and on the face of it, also really bad, because, I mean, 6 mystic defense is superb, but 2 physical and 2 energy, where they're by far the most common attacks in the game, is awful. But he does have very, very important power, Mind Over Matter, 2 cost reactive power. When this character is targeted by an attack or make a dodge roll, you may use the superpower. The character uses its mystic defense to defend or dodge. So whenever he needs to defend himself, he can bring that stat of 2 up to 6, even when he's dodging. And that makes his defenses go from awful to brilliant.
Yeah, he does have 2 attacks, and kind of on brand, right? They are mystic attacks, right? He has Black Tongue, which is just like a horrible mental image. I don't really want to think about it. it has a wild that says, after this attack is resolved, you may advance the target character short, which is huge, right? Kind of shades of Loki in there. And then after the attack is resolved, this character also gains 1 damage. So he doesn't have the traditional strike builder. His free attack has control built onto it with a wild, and then he only gains 1 power from it. He also has Herald of Doom, which apparently he whispers into you with his Black Tongue. Range 4, 8 attack dice, cost of 4. The target character does not gain, and this is important, the target character does not gain power for damage dealt from this attack, and there's a wild thrown tossed on the end. It is worth noting that the throw is separate from Herald of Doom, so any damage they take from the throw, they will generate power for, but the actual damage from the attack of Herald of Doom, they will not, and I love that effect. I think it's super strong.
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah, I mean, it's just a huge amount of damage with none of the repercussions, right? You can do a big spike to a target. They won't get power for it. You're less worried about what they're going to do when they recover from the attack. Probably they're going to flip to their injured side after taking 8 mystic, stand up, and then not do nearly as much as they otherwise would. Seems very, very strong. Then in addition to that, he's got Telekinetic Powerhouse. This is a really good throw. It's good because it doesn't throw characters, unfortunately. It throws terrain of size 4 or less within 3 and throws it long. It costs him 3. This is a great throw. And then he's got incredible psychic potential. During the power phase, this character gains 2 additional power. So just like Hulk, he's creating 3 power a turn plus potentially more with his Black Tongue ability. To top it all off, he has Flight, which is always a useful power to have. And he's the gem bearer for the Mind Gem and the Space Gem.
Yeah, so what do we think about Ebony Maw? He's a lot to unpack, right? Where Black Dwarf has the subtlety of smashing things and just not dying, Ebony is kind of hard to evaluate, right?
Very hard to evaluate. So I think all of it is colored by the fact he's 5 threat, because I think everything on his card is good, but he's just so expensive. And so much of it is power is relative to his threat cost. Like, his attacks are good, but Black Tongue is not that impressive for a 5 threat character, right? We expect our 5 threat characters to do 6 dice with their attacks. He's probably going to be compared most often to MODOK, who has Psionic Blast, which is doing 6 dice. His resilience is good, but it costs him a lot of power to keep his defenses up, and his hit points, as I said already, are real bad. And his throw is strong, but he can't move characters around, so he can dish out some damage. But is it enough for 5 threats? I'm just not sure about this guy. I think he's really cool. I've got no idea if he's good.
Yeah, he's a weird one. I've only gotten one game, and staying on brand, I take a new character and I jam into Avengers because that's just what I do. He's a pretty good Avenger.
He's a great Avenger.
He likes Cap being next to him. Mind over matter makes it so Cap doesn't have to be next to him all the time. I like throwing things across two. Some of the negatives are he's really expensive. And it was kind of like when I was testing Loki with a gem. Obviously, mm-hmm. It's a similar kind of role where they fit in. But ultimately, I liked Loki just a little bit more than I like Ebony, albeit super. Like, I have one game. Like, I get it. Like coronavirus, the world might be ending. I wish I played more. I'm sorry. I've only gotten one game with Ebony Maw. So I like him. He's one of the characters that I think even listening to us podcast about him, like people need to get him on the table to really see and understand kind of the things he can do. And he's one of the heroes that I'm looking forward to the most is really, really playing more. Because I think he might actually be incredible, but I think he's going to take a lot of finesse to use, right? I don't think he's going to be like a Black Dwarf, right? Where it's just like, I just put him on the table. He's pretty good. Ebony is going to require some thought, some planning, and a pretty good roster to support.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think I'd be really interested to see what people do with him and how he fits into their teams. I think when you see him opposite you on the table, you have to be super wary of him because he's definitely a powerful character. And I think he's going to be really challenging to play against with his sinister influence on Black Tongue. He can do a lot. And if you add a gem on top of that, then he could be a real headache.
Yeah, and I like him, right? And I think him and... Well, is there anything else you want to talk about him, or can we talk about him a little more holistically now?
No, let's do it.
So I like him and Black Dwarf kind of embodying the slower, more defensive side of Black Order. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas opposed to previously, we looked at Corvus and Proxima, who were just like, let's get up the table, let's hit them with this big alpha, and let's see if there's anything left afterwards. Right.
Yeah. So I like that they are.
Yeah. Right. I like the disparate nature between them, and that's kind of one of the reasons that I think Ebony is really, really hard to evaluate. Right. He's not as intuitive as the other characters. We need to kind of get him out there and see how he does. So, like, I love Telekinetic Powerhouse. I wish it could throw heroes. I love Herald of Doom. I wish the Wild Throw didn't have the size 2 quantifier attack on it, right? Mm-hmm. Black Tongue is kind of cool. I like Fishing for Sinister Influence. But at the same time, I wish he generated more power. I know he has the additional power-up, but, like, I want a little bit more out of it. So I do personally, when I look at his attacks, like, I consider them. I know you said you want to get 6 dice out of someone, and you compare them to MODOK, and... Yeah, MODOK's base attack is just better, right? But this is a mystic mm-hmm. attack. So, like, an attack 5 mystic, that's as good as a base 6 physical, right? In some situations.
Against the right target, sure.
Right. So I think there's value to him. But it's for me, it's really hard to quantify. And I know this doesn't make for great podcast content, but I need to get him on the table more myself.
Yeah, I think one of the things that he might struggle with is even with his incredible psychic potential, because Black Tongue is only giving him 1, he has actually got quite limited ability to generate power. You're getting 3 a turn. If you attack with Black Tongue, 4. You sit and do nothing else, maybe 5. But Mind Over Matter costs 2. So you are really torn between having good defenses and using your Herald of Doom and your Telekinetic Powerhouse. And I think the opportunity cost to using those good attacks is going to be so high. Because if you leave him without power, he's incredibly vulnerable to retaliation. And his defense is so low that he could easily be taken out, especially if he's already injured. Like, a single big attack threatens to KO him when he's on 2 defense and 4 health.
I don't like him with either the mind or the space gem, because I don't feel that he has the ability and the power to spend on them.
Yeah, I kind of agree. They give you power, but they cost more than they give. And he's already a character who is fragile, and I don't want to give a fragile character a gem.
Yeah, and the mind gem brings him up to 6. The space gem puts him to 7, right? Yeah, 7, which is just that's a lot.
Yeah. One thing I would say is Black Order are really expensive, right? We've got Corvus and Proxima clocking in at 3 and 4, but really wanting to be taken together for a 7-point package. Black Dwarf is 4, and Maw is 5. And we can't imagine that Thanos is going to be cheap, right? So it might just be that when you're playing Black Order, you want to be taking a gem or two to give you cheaper options so that your team works at different threat values. And you might find that you're giving more a gem just because you've got a spare point to play with.
No, I think that's a great point. So I think that's kind of a natural segue to talk about the Infinity Gem space. Does that sound okay for you, Pat?
Infinity Gem space, two threats. It has a two-cost active power, Space Gem. Choose this character or another allied character within range 3 and place it within range 2 of its current position. This superpower can be used only once per turn. So this is very similar to Red Skull's ability to place people. You're getting, of course, the passive ability that all the gems have of getting one extra power. Being able to place a character range 2 is pretty similar to a move action. It's pretty equivalent. Being able to place it on other characters as well as the bearer is obviously valuable. But do we think it's valuable enough for two threats? That's always the question with these gems. Are they worth the price you pay for them?
So you kind of hit the nail on the head for me. I would rather find two additional threat and just play Red Skull. That's
it does.
No, I'm just.
My God, yeah. This gem makes Red Skull look real cheap, doesn't it?
Yeah, he's a bargain all of a sudden. Like, I think it's a fine gem. The two threat coming on top of it with a relatively speaking expensive activation for me makes it not super appealing right now. Like, there are characters that really benefit from the movement. We just talked about Black Dwarf, right? He would love the teleport. But like, that's a lot of threat and it's a lot of power.
Yes. Yeah. It's obviously a strong effect, but I just can't get my head around spending two threat on a gem. I mean, I mentioned that when we talked about the time gem, when we were looking at Corvus Glaive. I think the space gem and the time gem compare really interestingly, because the time gem gives you another activation, which is more flexible for the bearer than the space gem. But the space gem lets you functionally have a move action or give somebody else a move action. So both cards are kind of giving you an extra action's worth of value. I'm not sure which is better. They both seem good, but I don't think either one of them is that appealing at two threat.
Yeah, it just kind of falls a little bit short for me personally. Is there anything else we need to hit on with the space gem?
No, I suppose we'll just have to wait and see how things shake out as more releases happen. It's always interesting to see these cards that enhance the power of everything else we've got because they're hard to quantify. And you never know, you might just down the line have such a powerful combination of effects that it's worth it, even at a high price.
Yeah, so even with us being a little down on the Infinity Gem, there are still three amazing other cards in the box. Which one of these do you think we should start with?
I think we should start with the card that's good, move on to the card that's great, and progress to the card that is absurd.
I wonder if we have these in the same order. Which card would you like to start with, Pat?
I would like to start with Marked for Death.
Okay, we are correct so far. One for one.
Okay, great. So, Marked for Death, unaffiliated active card. Two allied characters that are within range 5 of the same enemy character may spend 1 power each to play this card. This round, the enemy character loses and cannot gain stealth. Its speed becomes short, and it modify or reroll its defense dice.
Yeah, so this card, Pat and I DM'd Pat, I messaged Pat as soon as we saw Mark for Death, and I'm like, finally, the answer we need for stealth, right? It's a really powerful card. Like, stealth isn't the reason we're taking it, but slowing someone down to speed S is huge. And then can't modify or reroll its defense dice is also really, really relevant, right? Looking at you, Black Panther.
Yes. I've seen a lot of people look at this on Facebook and say it's bad because there's only one stealth character, Black Widow, even if she's got two versions. And I think they're missing the point, because just like you said, this card does three things, and you don't need to get use out of all three for it to be good. I'd say any one of them can be clutch, and two is really strong. I don't think there's a character in the game right now that gets all three on their own without help from outside sources, because Widow doesn't modify or reroll her defense dice without help. But, you know, if she was in Wakanda or something, then it would matter. But yeah, the thing that this card screams to me is kill the extract holder, right? That guy that's holding the scroll or the alien ship, and is trying to run away, this card makes it easier to target them, makes it so they run away slower, and makes it so they're going to have a harder time staying alive.
Yeah, I think that's the obvious one. The other one for me is prevent the secondary extract pickup, right? There's a lot of times where there's a fast character out wide, you're not able to get to something because maybe your winger fell and you're not going to be able to get out there quickly enough. There's mm-hmm. a lot of control, in my opinion, for shortening down that movement. That's the biggest thing that I see personally.
Yes. The other thing that I see with this card is a pretty good use case. And one of the reasons why I think this card is really good is because in addition to using it to, as the name suggests, mark someone for death and take them out more easily, I think it's a really interesting control card where you focus on the speed reduction coupled with the high range, where if somebody has a really scary character, and I'm going to throw out Thor as that great example of a character with a charge who wants to get up in there and is terrifying to face against, you can hit them early with this so they become slow and really ruin their plans for the round. And if you can combine it with someone like Shuri, right, where she's within range 5, you slow the character and then you push them away, you can completely mitigate their impact for that round. And for me, mitigating the activation of Thor for a round is well worth a tactics card.
Yeah, I think those are both great points. I'm glad you mentioned Shuri. I think that's amazing. The other thing I'm going to throw out there real quick is Spider Sense. So Spider Sense mm-hmm. already exists in the game, right? And it's when defending against physical or energy or dodging, right? You can reroll 2 dice, right?
Yeah.
And exactly. We know that more spider people are coming out into the game. And I am assuming, mm-hmm. this is an assumption, that spider sense is going to be pretty common, especially with the play that kind of Venom has, right? It's like the anti-spider guy. So I only think Mark for Death value is going to increase. I think it's a really good card. I think there's a lot of underrated utility to it. And yeah, I was surprised when people on Facebook were down on it. I think it's a great card. I really like it. This card fights for a spot in my 8.
Yes, me too. I think it's strong, and especially because it's cheap to use and it's unaffiliated, I can see it cropping up in a lot of places.
And it has a huge range, right? I know there are quantifiers on it, and I think we talked on this, but like two of your characters need to be within range 5 of the target. That's fine. That's better than one of my characters and the other one having an odd number of power and it being an even activation sequence. Like, I think it's a relatively speaking easy to play this card.
Yes, for sure. And a good one. So now...
So we have two cards left, Pat, right?
Yes.
We have and Mothership. One of which mm-hmm. we think is great. The other one we think is absurd. So go ahead, Pat. Which one of these is great?
The card that I think is great is
Okay, we agree. We have the cards ranked in the same order, at least. That's great.
Good. Phew. Okay, so is unaffiliated reactive. It requires Ebony Maw. When an enemy character within range 5 of an allied Ebony Maw spends 1 or more power to use an active or reactive superpower, Ebony Maw may spend 3 power to play this card. The enemy superpower has no effect and cannot be used again for the rest of this turn, but the character still spends the power cost of the superpower and is considered to have used the superpower.
We have Counterspell.
Right? Who'd have thought?
So this is just another reason that I don't think Ebony Maw has any extra power whatsoever, because I think is a really powerful card and one that I think is really valuable to have on Ebony, especially when we're looking at our opponent's team, right? You obviously want to see which actions we can stop with it, which superpowers we can kind of catch. And any superpower with an action is obviously going to be, you know, we talked about Thor a lot, right? For Asgard, right, you would cancel that. Mm-hmm. Thor still counts as spending it. So Thor still used an action and 3 power to use it.
I actually have to spring in there. AMG clarified that's not the case, unfortunately. He spent
that's good power, to know.
But he hasn't. He counts as having used the power, but he doesn't actually use the power. So the reason that's important is charge and for Asgard, which are functionally, you know, the same effect, can only be used once a turn. So because he counts as having used it, he can't do it again. But he hasn't used it, so he doesn't lose an action.
Okay, that is good to know. I played that wrong in my game with them, and hopefully they update the FAQ, but thank you for jumping in there with that update there, Pat. So that knocks it down a little bit for me, but it still is really powerful, right? There's so many superpowers out there that we want to stop. I think it's a very powerful card.
Yeah, I agree. I think even without the action loss from charges and similar effects, stopping them is still often the equivalent of making a character lose an action, right? Because that's functionally what they do, is they give you that free move action to let them make two attacks. So I think it's still a great target for Shush. And then, in addition, I think it just becomes really difficult for your opponent to plan their turn effectively, knowing that at any point, like, a cog in their machine could be removed by Ebony Maw, right? And a thing that they want to do will just fail to work, and that character will have a crappy activation. Yeah, do you think there's any particularly choice targets for this card?
I do. Before we go into targets, I want to hit on something you just said, and it's actually really similar to Magic, right? I know I made a counterspell joke. I feel like this card is more powerful in your hand than being played because of the mental gymnastics your opponent has to jump through. So I just want to float that out there, that I think that you shouldn't always rush to use this card. Be judicious about what you're canceling with it. Because, like, a lot of times I think I would rather have the threat of this card in my hand and making my opponent, again, jump through the mental gymnastics of using it than get it out there. Some big ones that immediately jump to mind are, we can start with Ebony Maw himself. In the mirror matchup, if you cancel a mind over matter, that can be huge, right? We're going from functionally 2 defense dice to 6. I think that's a good, obvious one right off the bat. So many snacks with Venom. That's often the way that Venom kind of stays on the board. Preventing one of those can be really big, right? Vision, stopping a rapid phase could also be huge. Anytime you're stopping a bodyguard, to me, is pretty relevant as well. And the other one, Pat's favorite character, Trickster, is a big one that I think has a lot of power. You'd be stopping a Trickster can be huge, right? Trickster costs a lot, and they really rely on that for Loki to live. If Loki just ends up, like, not moving, that's a big deal.
Yes, especially because Trickster is another one of those powers that can only be used once a turn. So you can stop it and then hit Loki twice, but he can't get away, which seems real good. There's a couple of powers that are really expensive that hurt a lot if you use Shush. And the one that I think is probably the most damaging is poor Captain Marvel, right, with binary form. When you spend 5 to use binary form and it gets shushed away, and I mean, that's her whole game plan, right? She's probably worked for several turns to get enough power. She's finally living the dream, and then it just gets evaporated.
Yeah, that's a good one. The other one I want to mention real quickly is actually Gamma Leap from Hulk. Hulk often counts on that place, right? That moves him so far because he's got that fat base on him. But again, if you can shut that down, that's a big deal, right?
Yeah, and similarly, right? Red Skull's Cube, right? Oftentimes, Red Skull's opening play, and I mean, on turn one, you're not going to shush him, right? And in theory, you could, because you'll have enough power. So maybe you do. Maybe that's an interesting counterplay to Red Skull, I don't know. But anyway, the point I'm trying to make is often Red Skull wants to generate power with his cube, advance forwards, and then move MODOK forwards, or someone else, but usually MODOK, with the cube. And just being able to then stop him using that cube. He still spends all the power. He's functionally wasted his turn because he spent an action generating the power that he's just lost. And MODOK is no further up the table. That kind of thing could really ruin your opponent's plans for their opening turns.
Yeah, and the last thing we want to mention is any kind of charge or throw. There's obviously just a lot of power with you know, the ones we pointed out are kind of specific things. I really like actually mentioning binary form. Like, I considered Friday AI, right? But that only costs 3. Mm-hmm. And if you had enough power, you could just do it again. But yeah, losing binary form would, that'd be bad. No one would like that.
Yeah,
you are not going to make any friends playing Shush, is what I will say. But I do think it is a great card. Is there anything else you want to cover with Shush?
I wanted to call out one particular interaction. You mentioned how the threat of it can limit what your opponent does. And I think one of the best examples of this is with Killmonger and Usurp the Throne, where Killmonger wants to usurp the throne, then charge, right? And having Shush just stops him being able to do that plan. because if he plays his upturn and then charges, you shush the charge. If he charges without playing his up the throne, he has to finish his attack before playing the card, so he loses out on the damage. And either way is a really unfortunate situation for him that could ruin his whole activation. And so just having this card makes something like a Zerp the Throne a lot worse.
No, I think that's a great point. Just another reason not to play Killmonger. That's hyperbole, obviously. Killmonger's fine. You can play Killmonger. Sorry.
You should play Killmonger. He's awesome. Cool. So
I'm going to mention this real quickly.
Oh, yeah.
I think is really, really, really strong into any of the encounters where you're playing on a team. So not super relevant for the focus of this podcast, but if you're playing any of the ultimate encounters, I would consider taking
Just to stop their crazy effects? Makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the heroes are so tuned up for that format that a lot of times you can get a lot of value out of stopping one of them. But again, not really the focus of this podcast. I just wanted to throw it out there. So the absurd card that Pat and I actually agreed upon is...
Mothership. Oh my gosh, this card. What the heck? Like, before we talk about Mothership, I just want to say, like, when we looked at Corvus Glaive and Pox of Midnight, we looked at two Black Order cards and we said, these Black Order cards are both great. We would always have them in our eight. They're a strong reason to play the affiliation. And now we get Mothership, and it blows those two out of the water. It's not even close. This card is now immediately shot to my front runner for best card in the game. So I'm going to read it, and then TT, you tell me if you agree or not. It is an active card for the Black Order. Two Black Order characters may both spend two power each to play this card. Place one of the two characters who is not holding an objective token within range one of the other character.
Yeah, it's monstrous. I think it's really, 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 really strong. The fact that there is no range requirement on them being within close to each other, they just both have to be in range of the mothership, it's insane. We just spent so much time talking about how Black Dwarf just wants to get up there and get in the middle of things. Well, if you want to use it early, here you go. Right, here's mothership. But there's a ton of power to it. And it is a mind-boggling card, right? Black Order's suite of tactics cards are really good, for lack of a better word.
They're nuts. Like, I think especially they are the best.
Like, we're looking at them at the same time that we're looking at the Guardians tactics cards, right? So it only hammers home. Yeah, like Crew of the Milano or Mothership. Yeah, make your own choice. I think Mothership is insane. I love it so much. There's just so much flexibility to it. It's really powerful, and it doesn't cost that much, right? Two power each. Like, you use that to get plus two attack dice and so many different things. Like, this is great. It's an incredible card.
Yeah. And so obviously the reason we think it's so good is it's such a huge amount of movement, right? It's any distance with no range restriction. So character anywhere on the table can move within range one of another character anywhere on the table. And I think the picture on Mothership is perfect because it shows Black Dwarf being teleported in front of Corvus Glaive and Proxima Midnight. Corvus Glaive and Proxima Midnight being the fast Black Order characters who want to be working together. And Black Dwarf being the slow one. It's a strong hint for a common play pattern with this card, right? Which is you can double move one of these two and then teleport in Black Dwarf. And you can threaten anywhere on the table that you need to be.
Yeah, it's real good, right? Proxima can move long, right? Then she can make a spear throw, which is a range three. Then she teleports within one of the target, and then she calls in Black Dwarf behind it. You're like, I don't know, it's a Black Dwarf. It's fine. And you can't attack Proxima because Black Dwarf's right there. He's going to redirect it with Inspiring Presence if you have any power left on him. Like, it's a really, really powerful card to deliver some models into some places that people otherwise didn't think they could get into, right? Pat and I talk ad nauseum about Shuri and other things, how much value and like time we spend on like pushing and slowing models down and this weird board control. And then Mothership, you just teleport models wherever you want. Just don't worry about it. It's fine.
Yeah, fix that problem for you. Bing. So I want to talk about a couple of obvious combos. We already mentioned Black Dwarf. That's the clear good choice in Black Order. I think it's worth mentioning that Corvus and Proxima are both fast characters who want to be near to each other, but it's quite cool that with this card, you can play them apart and then bring them together later in the game. And you could even do a situation where if they have to split up, one of them can activate, do their thing that they need to do, and then teleport into range of the other to then activate them. I think that's a pretty cool combo. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention, this is not so much a combo, but something to be wary of, is I think that one thing that could happen with this is a big trap, which is already Corvus and Proxima want to be close together. Black Order's characters are expensive. You're not going to have a lot of characters. If you are teleporting Black Dwarf next to Corvus and Proxima, you are putting all of your characters real close together. And this card only works once. So I could see a situation where you get giddy with the power of Mothership, throw Black Dwarf across the table, have a really effective turn, and then realize that you've got no good way of bringing him back to where he needs to be. And you might get a temporary advantage, but if you don't plan accordingly, you could actually lose out long-term by doing a big movement with no way to return to a more even position.
No, I think that's a great point. So as much as I like it, so let's be clear. The versatility of the card is one of its many, many, many benefits. So as much benefit as I see is moving someone ahead early, I actually really like it for calling Corvus or Proxima back home. Corvus, with the flurries attached to Deathblow, or excuse me, he gets the movement attached to Deathblow with the additional flurry, right? I've dug Corvus pretty deep sometimes where I'm like, okay, well, he's just going to die. There's no way he can survive because he's dug so deep. But, you know, you might end up, especially if you end up with a flurry, so your last attack is a strike, you have a couple power back on you, you could Mothership him back to relative safety, right? You could end up making two or three medium moves with Corvus and then teleporting him back to the middle of the board so he's still relevant. So I like it for that. I like it for overcommitting and overpowering a flank, but then still being able to pull one of the models back to the middle of the table where you really need them as well. So I like it more for repositioning than initial positioning, if that makes sense, Pat. But the versatility on this card is amazing.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I think if you like it for that play, and that play sounds great to me, then Ebony Maw is going to be really appealing, right? Because he's your Black Order character that wants to sit at the back. And because of his extra power generation, he's always going to be a valid target for Mothership on characters that played before him. So that seems really great. I think you could do a cool play, like you mentioned, where Corvus goes, digs deep, activates Proxima, and then he teleports back to Ebony. That seems awesome. Then Proxima goes, she gets out of dodge, and you've gone from having two characters to none before anyone is activated. The only problem I think this card has, it's not really a problem, it's more of like a well-needed balancing factor, but it especially inhibits the play of pulling characters back, is just the fact that you can't pull back a character if they're holding an objective. And often the reason you want to dig characters deep is to pick up those extracts.
Yeah, and I think that's a great balancing point. The other check and balance of this card, I'm going to say, is double Black Order. So I think it's a fine quantifier to have in it, but I've seen a lot of lists revolving around Bucky in Black Order just to get us a little bit of flexibility and some of the point breaks, because right now we're at 5-3-4-4, right? Corvus and Black Dwarf coming in at 4, Ebony at 5. So I've seen Bucky being tossed around there a lot, and Mothership, I want options when I'm playing this card. I want there to be, I don't want this card to be meaningless. Just another balance I want to point out is like it does require both sides of the teleport to be Black Order characters.
Yes, for sure. Overall, though, I love it. I think it's really, really cool. I think the way that I could see it being played most often is as the Black Order version of Gamma Launch, right? It's a way to get a character into action quickly. And because of the power requirement, I can see a situation where at the start of turn two, the first character you activate is Black Dwarf. He's got his second power, one for the first turn, one for the second, and you immediately throw him within range one of whichever of your other characters is near an enemy, probably Corvus or Proxima, and then he hits that person twice, does a huge amount of damage. That seems to me like a really good, easy to replicate use case for this card.
Yeah, I do think there's obviously parallels comparing it to Gamma Launch, right? They both still have the qualification of no objective tokens or anything like that on them. I think it's a powerful card. I think it'll be really interesting how people choose to unfurl it. I do agree with you that I think most people will use it for the early positioning alpha, right? To try to break or speed up the stalemate of kind of two armies kind of slowly moving towards each other in round one. I think it's a great card. I really like Mothership.
Me too.
Yeah.
Do you agree with me when I said that it's my hot take best card in the game?
I have one card in my head that I personally think rivals it. And sure, I don't. Yeah, we can have this conversation. I'm going to mention field dressing again. I think field dressing, for a couple reasons, might edge out Mothership. One, field dressing is unaffiliated. And field dressing fundamentally breaks a core mechanic of the game. And we talked about this in the after the credit scene, right? But I don't know. I really like field dressing.
That's fair. I thought you were going to say Wakanda Forever. And I think I'm being a bit silly when I say Mothership is definitely the best. I think it's in the running. It's one of the best cards in the game for sure. It's a compelling reason to play Black Order. And they already had two great cards, right? Now they've got three. I think they've got the best selection of affiliated Team Tactics cards that we've seen.
Wakanda Forever is really good, but like... Let's just talk about Black Order for a minute. Do you like Mothership or Price of Failure more?
I like Mothership more. I really like Price of Failure. Although now that we've seen the Black Order team, we know they're quite expensive. But then again, Price of Failure doesn't require the characters to be affiliated. I also really like that other card whose name I forget. Something about blood.
Blood Despair?
Blood to Spare, thank you. I think I rate Mothership right now, if I had to put together a roster just blindly, not knowing what my characters are, having not really used the cards very much, I would rate Mothership first. That would probably always make my five. Then Price of Failure would usually make my five and always be in my eight. And Blood to Spare would probably be in my eight and sometimes make my five. Does that sound about right? I think they're all considering.
I don't see when I would ever not take Price to Failure for my five. Like, I have a hard time. I guess, like, if I end up with, like, Ebony Maw with a gem, Thanos at some ungodly price, and Black Dwarf, maybe I don't take it. Like, once Ebony Maw's flipped and he's on that four stamina side, I'm like, hey, man, you look like a tasty six power to me. So I just don't know when I wouldn't take Price to Failure. But we're quibbling at this stage. Like, they have a really, really strong package of Team Tactics cards, right? I think we're both in agreement there.
Really strong. They're very cool.
All right, Pat. Well, I think that's a great recap of the latest additions to the Black Order, and we can't wait for Thanos to come out. When Thanos does hit, obviously we'll do an emergency pod, try to get that out to you guys as soon as possible. I want to thank you all so much for listening. Let us know what you think of the Black Order. You can let us know on Twitter or Facebook. I'm on Twitter at Sung Soo. You can find Pat Dunford, or myself, Sung Soo, on Facebook. And of course, Discord. Let us know what you think of the models too. So thank you everyone so much for listening. And in these weird, uncertain times, we wish you all good health and happy game.
Somewhere across the Bifrost, way up. There's a pod that I've heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere across the Bifrost skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true.
Yeah, and that's actually, obviously we don't know the space gem yet. We haven't gotten a spoiler for the space gem. But that's one reason why, for me, the mind gem is...
Yes.
We have gotten the space gem?
The space gem is in this box. This box has it all.
Oh, yeah. I knew that. We haven't covered the space gem yet. I don't mind. How do we want to do this then? That's fine. I will talk about both of them at the same time. I can't believe I forgot that they had the space gym.
The way it's positioned on the page is easy to miss.
No, and then I'll be honest with you, the space gym was so uninspiring to me. I was just like, oh yeah, that. Okay, cool.
The two cost gems are just too expensive. They're just...
If you... Okay, so here's my pseudo hot take, and I didn't want to say it on the podcast. If you take the space gem and you mind it with the mind gem, I probably would take them. Like, if I could move an ally character or an enemy character, okay, cool, I'll do that. But yeah, I'm not a big fan.
Yeah. Agreed.
All right, so, but yeah, I'm just going to kill Ebony Maw with Price of Failure all the time. Like, I just don't mind. And then with them being so expensive, like, I'm going to have Nebula or Rocket, right? I'm going to have someone cheap. I'm like, yep, sorry, Rocket.
Yeah.
It was a good run, buddy. You look like 12 power. Like,
I think, that's the best case for it, isn't it? When you have your expendable 2-point goon, and then they're the one that pays the price for failure.
Well, and Nebula is kind of a perfect character for that, right?
Like, yeah, honestly, I think all the 2-cost characters are perfect for it, right? Because they're all either really fragile or they get put in a lot of danger.
And that's my thing with Nebula, right? I see her going out there, doing her job, right? Dropping an objective and being like, okay, well, you're done. Like, you can't pick that up. Like, okay, come on home. Price of Failure is just really good. And like I said, is really powerful. Blood Despair is really good. Like, I don't remember what we said when we talked about Execute, but Execute isn't a bad card, right? Execute and...
Yeah. The more I think about Execute, and I've played with it now as well a few times, I think it is a bad card. But it's not, like, on its surface, it's not a bad card. It just suffers from being a combo card. It needs two characters. And the problem is, they're two characters that already are quite good at turning power into damage and that don't have that much power to use.
So yeah, my biggest complaint with Execute is the fundamental limitation. Yeah. For me, Execute just always felt like overkill. Like, I was already going to daze this character. Like, you're not... Mm-hmm. It's not really getting me that many places, but, and then I hate overly specific cards like that. Like, 2 Black Order characters, that's great. I can make that work.